Good afternoon. My name is Bill Lawrence. I'm the Dean at Perkins School of Theology, and I'm delighted to welcome you this afternoon to our Public Life Personal Faith Symposium. This is the first formal event of a sequence of events that was established here at Perkins School of Theology a couple of years ago for the purpose of bringing distinguished leaders to our campus. First, for a conversation that is more academic in nature. Second, for a discussion, a presentation that is intended for a somewhat wider audience, but both bringing to our community persons of national and international renown to share with us some insights into the general concept of public life and personal faith. I want to express deep gratitude to the naming sponsors of this year's Public Life Personal Faith Symposium, specifically to Jim and Judy Gibbs, and to the Gene and Jerry Jones family, who are honoring Major Ward and Captain Michelle Matthews, DFW Metroplex Commanders of the Salvation Army. It's okay to stand. The Public Life Personal Faith Luncheon and Symposium is a combination of an intellectual discussion about pertinent topics and a fundraising event. Why not? We're in academic life. That's one of the things that we do. It's part of the school's outreach to serve the community. This school exists with a mission to prepare women and men for faithful leadership in Christian ministry. We participate through cooperation with the Department of Religious Studies in Dedman College and the two ethics professors who hold endowed university chairs, the Scurlock chair and the McGuire chair, in constituting the faculty for the PhD program, the graduate program in religious studies. All of us together believe that we are engaged in an enterprise that has both an internal and an external witness, that we are to be engaged in conversations not only about the way we participate in developing and forming the lives of those whom we educate, but also the ways that we think, speak, make choices, and live our lives in the public arena. The lecture and the symposium provide opportunities for participants to hear some of the finest scholars in the land discuss topics related to how and why one's personal faith shapes one's public life, and how and why personally held faith has a public witness and a public dimension. The beneficiary, in many ways, at least financially, of this effort is the Center for Religious Leadership at Perkins School of Theology, which provides training and practical skills for leadership based on an understanding of ministry that is a spiritual calling cultivated, strengthened, and lived out, not only within the Christian community, but also in the larger context of the land. The Center for Religious Leadership fosters a development of theological understandings of leadership through teaching skills and practices that are required for managing the economic, legal, business, and cultural dimensions of the communities of faith. And I will say there are plenty of people who feel and express a felt call to ministry who do not realize that once they're engaged in the actual practice of ministry, they're in an endeavor that has important implications which are legal, architectural, financial, and a whole lot of other things they didn't even imagine were going to be part of their professional lives. Well, it's my honor and privilege as the Dean of Perkins to introduce to you the principals who are here on this occasion. I'm going to introduce our presenter, our lecturer, and then after she has completed her presentation, I will introduce the two persons who will be responding. I'll care for both of those introductions at the same time, and then they will speak to you in sequence. But let me begin simply with the first introduction, the introduction of our Public Life Personal Faith Lecturer for 2012. Dr. Diane Winston holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at the University of Southern California. a national authority on religion and the media. As both a journalist and a scholar, her expertise includes religion, politics, and the news media, as well as religion and the entertainment media. Dr. Winston's current research interests are media coverage of Islam, religion, and new media, and the place of religion in American identity. At the University of Southern California, she teaches courses that examine religion as it relates to journalism, visual media, American history, and foreign policy. Her class on international reporting about religion has taken students to cover conflict and coexistence in Israel and Palestine, and their subsequent work has appeared in outlets that include the Washington Post, the Jerusalem Post, and the Huffington Post. I'm sure she doesn't limit her outputs to those that use the word post in their title. Her course, called Hollywood, Faith, and Media, deals with spirituality and ethics in television dramas and has hosted writer-directors including David Shore of House, Nancy Franklin of Saving Grace, and Ron Moore of Battlestar Galactica. Her guest lectures are available on YouTube, and she has hosted conferences on post-9/11 television and the war on terror, conferences on religion and electoral politics, conferences on Islam and new media. Her current research is on religion and the news media, and she's finishing two books. One is called The Oxford Handbook on Religion and the American News Media. The other, Heartland Religion, the American News Media, and the Reagan Revolution, which is due from Oxford University Press in 2013. The Oxford Handbook is an edited volume with sections on world religions, religion and hot-button issues, the history of religion and the news in the United States, and the religious press. She wrote the book's introduction and a chapter exploring the coverage of religion and sexuality in the early reporting on AIDS in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and Dallas Morning News. Her book, Heartland Religion, revisits the 1970s and 80s to explore how the news media contributed to the conservative ideological shift that became known as the Reagan Revolution. Between 1983 and 1995, Dr. Winston covered religion at the Raleigh News and Observer, where the number one sport is basketball. And she covered religion for the Dallas Times-Herald, where the number one sport is football. And she also reported for the Baltimore Sun, contributed regularly to the Dallas Morning News. She has won numerous Press Association awards. She was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for her work in Raleigh, Dallas, and Baltimore. Her articles have appeared in the major newspapers and electronic publications that deal with issues concerning religion and the media. Educationally, she earned her PhD in 1996 from Princeton University. She holds master's degrees from Harvard Divinity School and from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Her work on American religion has explored evangelicalism, gender, consumer culture, and urbanization. Her published volumes, besides the ones that are on their way to the market, include Red Hot and Righteous, The Urban Religion of the Salvation Army, Faith in the Market, Religion and the Urban Commercial Culture, and Small Screen Picture, Lived Religion and Television. Dr. Winston and her family live in Los Angeles. Her husband, Chris Bugby, is Director of Media Relations at Cal State Fullerton, and their daughter, Isabel, is a seventh grader at Immaculate Heart Middle School. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Diane Winston.
Thank you, Dean Lawrence. Thank you, Todd Raspberry. Thanks for everyone for coming out. It's always wonderful to be back in Dallas, and I just saw that skyline last night, and my heart leapt. So thank you for inviting me. I recently gave a talk at a rabbinical school in L.A., and I called it Torah or TV, Why True Blood is Winning. I'm hoping some of you have watched True Blood, right? It's a vampire show on HBO. I really don't think that Moses has anything to worry from Vampire Bill, but I wanted to make the point that an increasing number of people find more meaning and inspiration in popular entertainment than they do in religious texts. Rather than debate whether this is a good thing or bad, I prefer to discuss why it is. The answer is multifaceted, and it needs to account for demographic shifts, cultural changes, and religious trends. But maybe most interesting to me is the media, the role of the media, the place of TV and the internet in creating identity, meaning, and community, and the possibility that in a broad sense, mediatized culture is religion. Let me repeat that. Mediatized culture is religion. It can be religious. Television, that home altar that creates both real and virtual communities, has entered a new age of storytelling that explores long-standing spiritual and ethical issues in today's vernacular. The internet offers new ways to form communities and make stories our own. My aim is to be more intentional about what we watch and how it influences what we believe, what we think, and what we do. This paper is an effort to do that. In Loving with a Vengeance, her book on mass-produced fantasies for women, feminist scholar Tanya Modlewski argues that a utopian sensibility, the desire for something more than what everyday life offers, helps account for the abiding popularity of romance novels, gothic fiction, and soap operas. That something more, she writes, is a desire for community, transcendence, and female autonomy. In the 30 years since Modlewski's book was published, social and cultural shifts have tweaked female fantasies, hence Vampire Bill, but the need for something more remains. Saving Grace, which ran on the cable network TNT from July 2007 to June 2010, illustrates the changes in continuity in women's desire for something more. Using Grace Hanadarko, the series heroine, as an example, I'd like to explore contemporary media representations of women and religion, as well as viewer responses to them. Modlewski's utopian sensibility reflects a very human need for identity, meaning, and community, the building blocks of spiritual searching and religious teaching. I will use Saving Grace to discuss how television affects our relationship with religion and spirituality and refer to mediatization, which is what scholars call the ongoing process in which media becomes more and more a part of our everyday life, society, and culture. Now, mediatization sounds complicated, so let me make it very clear what I mean. Once upon a time, we went to the bank to deposit and withdraw money. Now we do it online. Once upon a time, we called people or met for coffee. Now we tweet, IM, and email. Once we went to political rallies and we volunteered at a candidate's office. Now we donate online and we organize on Facebook. In all these examples, we are conducting more and more of our lives through media. The question is, how does that affect the interactions we have, as well as our understanding of ourselves, our community, and of the possibility for transcendence? The question of what occurs when so much of our daily interaction happens through media is significant because media is not neutral. It has its own logic. Whether you are reading a newspaper, watching a movie, or trolling online, media is as much about selling you something as it is about informing and entertaining you. Media logic means the demands of consumption will lead to commodification. Consider why you use media and how it hooks you. Does it dumb things down, spice them up, make connections look easy? And if any of these are true, how might they affect our relationships as well as real-world institutions? Take TV. The conditions of viewership and production are no longer fixed. It used to be they made it and we watched it. But online opportunities have created new feedback loops between producers and consumers of content. Today, viewers can produce content, and producers can respond on fanzines, fan sites, and YouTubes. Audiences once accustomed just to watching shows can now interact with them. Even better, they can enter into the worlds of these shows. They can do that through online games, through blogs, and through affinity groups constituted by social media networks. Producers can respond to viewers online and integrate their ideas into scripts and develop transmedia products, whether comic books or webisodes, that offer new dimensions to an original story. And the show Lost is a great example of what I mean. The smaller communities that develop around particular aspects of a story, forums that speculate on alternative relationships between the characters or YouTube collaborations that extend the narrative, bypass the constraints of media logic, which require producers to present stories that ensure the largest possible audience. Now, back in the days when we just had three big networks, media logic meant hiring the most attractive actors, writing the least offensive scripts, and providing happy endings to ensure the largest possible viewership. With the advent of digitalization and the explosion of cable networks, many stations jettisoned this lowest common denominator approach to serve niche audiences. New shows cater to viewers who like baking cakes, taking care of animals, gardening, or even who have a passion for antiheroes. HBO, a cable pioneer, promoted quality entertainment. Its tagline boasted, "It's not TV, it's HBO." The network thrived, inaugurating a new golden era of television with shows like Oz, Six Feet Under, The Sopranos, and The Wire. Many of these shows probed questions of meaning, identity, and community. Yet rather than reflect a utopian sensibility, the desire for something more, they reflected a world weariness that seemed to wonder, is this all there is? Significantly, those shows, Oz, Six Feet Under, The Sopranos, and The Wire, were developed by men and anchored by male characters. Each had strong female roles, but women were not the heart of the drama. Well, Six Feet Under may be an exception. At Lifetime, a cable channel aimed at women, female characters were central, but they tended to appear in traditional romantic scripts retrofitted for new cultural realities. In the 2000s, however, several cable networks debuted shows with female leads that were as flawed as any ambivalent mafia don. Damages, Patty Hughes, Weeds, Nancy Botwin, Nurse Jackie's Jackie Payton are all perverse characters. Their spiritual struggles are only glimpsed at the edges of their ambition, insecurity, and narcissism. Grace Hanadarko is equally difficult but markedly different. Her backstory darker, her personality edgier. Compounding her problems was the writer's decision not to place her in the familiar terrain of melodrama or dramedy. Rather, Saving Grace unfurls in an unfamiliar mashup of police procedural and magic realism. Its hero struggles neither for worldly success nor romantic love, but for the redemption that comes with accepting herself and submitting to a higher power. Nancy Miller, the series creator, says she wanted to do a show to explore God, faith, religion, and sin, and do a show about a reluctant saint. She also wanted a strong female character, hence Grace Hanadarko. The petite blonde ripped through the 2007 summer season, smoking, drinking, and fornicating, heralding a very different type of television hero. Grace has a last chance angel named Earl who sweeps her off her feet, alights on a remote mountaintop, and tells her it's time to change. Now, obviously, it would be great if I had some clips here, but I just didn't do that. So I suggest all of you, if you can, go home, try to download some episodes if you haven't seen Saving Grace to see what I'm talking about. Some critics panned the supernatural twist, but viewers related to Grace's dark night of the soul. That dark night deepened when on the first season finale, Grace points her gun at the priest who had molested her during her preteen years. But as she prepares to kill Father Satan Murphy, her nickname for him, he whispers words that hold out hope for more than revenge. Whispering the same phrase Earl did, Murphy becomes a divine conduit, reminding Grace that she has a choice and that God has chosen her. God has chosen her. Gender roles are among the most ingrained aspects of religion, establishing men and women's relationships to spirituality, sexuality, and power, shaping in these arenas what they can say, what they may do, and how they understand themselves. Within Western Christianity, gender roles have been set by defining archetypes, and since the formation of the biblical canon, there have been two preeminent classifications for women, whore and Madonna. Even today, when women have penetrated the innermost circles of religious power, these deep-rooted typologies are culturally pervasive, reducing women to bodies for recreation or procreation. The theological narrative that flows from Grace Hannah Darko's life offers an alternate vision of a religious woman. Rather than accept traditional prescriptions of the holy woman's role, Grace is rambunctious and only begrudgingly open to God's call. She functions as a counterpoint to friends and family who follow more conventional paths to redemption, and she holds out hope for and elicits sympathy from viewers eager for fresh perspectives. At the heart of her story is an unsought and unwanted religious calling, a calling, the perception that that a supernatural power has a special plan for one's life is a staple of Western religious literature. Grace's calling borrows from Judaism, the notion that being called entails unquestioning submission to God's will, from Roman Catholicism, the vision of an experience outside of everyday life, and from Protestantism, the idea that after a call, one returns to everyday life. Hers is a private call, direct, which has her remain in the world, albeit with a different intentionality. That intentionality demands that she treat herself with the same respect and compassion she shows others. As her best friend Retta says, "You are the kind of person who loves everyone more than yourself." When the series begins, Grace is an Oklahoma City detective who seeks the justice that she herself has been denied. Her job and her personal life play out within a close-knit police unit and a loosely knit family. Her friend Retta is a forensic sex expert and a devout Catholic. She is the only person who knows that Grace has been abused and that she has been visited by an angel. Grace meets Earl when, after a night of hard drinking, she drives her Porsche into a pedestrian. Desperate to revive him, she calls on God. When a scruffy, gray-haired man appears and says God sent him, Grace fears she is crazy. When he unfurls a great set of white wings, she knows she's lost her mind. In this and subsequent meetings, Grace makes known that Earl's appearance is anything but good news. Rather, it is the beginning of ongoing resistance as she runs from God's call. When that first night, Grace questions whether Earl is the real deal, he transports her to the Grand Canyon. He tells her she's going to hell unless she accepts God's love. When she refuses, he stirs up a tremendous storm. She grabs his hand and he wraps her in his wings. He says that he, like FedEx, is just delivering the message. Grace's spiritual journey is hidden from those who judge her, whether at work or in her own family. Yet she is continually tested by her cases and through her human relationships. Rather than explain God's purpose, Earl plants clues for her. Grace takes a feather from his wings and a half-eaten taco so Retta can test his DNA. As Grace comes to believe in him, she begins to believe in herself. Viewers see small changes as she becomes more self-accepting. She tries to stop lying, she is more rigorous in her professional conduct, and she will not let herself be compromised by others' opinions of her, especially of her sexuality. Now, initially, Grace treats sex as sort of uncomplicated and fun. That's it. She sleeps with two of her fellow detectives. Butch Ada is single and ready to commit. Ham Dewey is married and emotionally unavailable. Of course, she likes Ham better because it's a less demanding relationship. She's hardly faithful. Coming to meet her one morning, Ham finds Grace handcuffed to the bed, sprawled backside up in a perverse tableau of a crucifixion. Seeing another man's name scrawled in lipstick across her posterior, he angrily refuses to free her. In another episode, Grace is splattered with blood during a shootout. When she enters the shower to rinse off, Ham helps wash the blood off her body. The theme of blood and water, repeated in other episodes, mirrors Christian themes of suffering, death, and redemption. Viewers may wonder whether redemption will come through Ham's human love or Earl's spiritual healing, but Grace behaves as if sexuality is its own path to salvation. She tries to purge the memory of the past by fully immersing herself in the intensity of vigorous copulation. Sex replaces, or at least allows her to control, the trauma of earlier violations. Yet her post-Earl couplings reveal that sex, too, is part of God's plan and inextricably linked to her spiritual journey. Over time, she stops bed-hopping and tries to develop a relationship with Ham, who has left his wife. Tellingly, however, it is only in the orgasmatron, that's her word, not mine, of Earl's embrace that Grace feels something overwhelming, as she puts it, better than sex. In the final moments of the first season, the themes of atonement, sacrifice, and salvation come together when Grace faces Father Murphy. Before going to find him, she cries to God. And here it's a shame because Holly Hunter does this much better than I can do it. God the powerful, the almighty God, you want me to talk to you, to turn to you, to believe in you? Why? Why the hell would I trust you? Why should anyone trust you? That baby dies, and Murphy ends up in a beautiful home with a goddamn rose garden? In a righteous rage, Grace sneaks up on her nemesis. When Murphy begs her not to stain her soul with his murder, she is unmoved. Only when he repeats Earl's words, "I'm just FedEx trying to deliver the message," is her hand stayed. Her face registers disbelief as the moment yields to the utopian sensibilities that Modlesky describes as the heart of female fantasy, the possibility of communion, transcendence, and autonomy. Grace becomes the avatar for the audience's spiritual longings as she perceives the truth. God is real. Her actions have meaning because she, Murphy, and the others she meets on her journey are linked through divine intentionality. Thanks to God's love, she has the freedom to choose, and her identity emerges from the decisions she makes. It's a deeply religious, personally empowering vision of the unity between self, God, and others. It's also a canny rendering of gender issues and religious messages in a way that works for television. And it illustrates mediatization's capacity, quote, to change the very ideas and authority of religious institutions and alter the ways in which people interact with each other when dealing with religious issues. Analyzing what kind of religion works on television, anthropologist Elizabeth Bird says programs that feature overtly religious characters and plots often fail. But, quote, the default position for TV drama is an assumption of faith, although leaving vague the question of exactly in what. Sort of like President Eisenhower's statement that everyone should believe in something, I don't care what it is. The open-ended religiosity helps all kinds of viewers, whether Jews, Muslims, Christians, or nuns, N-O-N-E-S, nuns, to identify with the characters. It also reflects the experience of those for whom religion is more about getting through the day than debating the finer points of faith. Non-specific spirituality, however, challenges traditional religions. Earl tells Grace that there are multiple roads to God and gives her holy objects from around the world. Miller, despite her own attachment to Catholicism, never suggests the church is the one true way. In fact, her familiarity with Catholicism may explain why she roots Grace's trauma in the very real issue of Catholic clergy sexual abuse. But that type of particularity, pointing out the religious identity of wrongdoers, is common on television, where true believers, that is, extremists and hypocrites, are always portrayed negatively, and their religious affiliations are always named. Among Saving Grace's viewers, the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church, which protected Father Murphy, was a hot online topic. Many posts came from men and women who were sexually abused. In a TNT thread titled Salvation and Forgiveness, Philip 164 sees Grace's experience in light of his own. Quote, I can and have forgiven myself because I have and can accept God's forgiveness. I have forgiven those who would hurt me. That said, I am not sure what I would do in Grace's position. The desire to pull the trigger would be oh so very strong. That thread, following the season's finale, includes 9 pages on sexual abuse, forgiveness, and finding God. Fan122B writes, quote, Grace is a beautiful angel which fell from the heavens. According to Deborah 195, Grace is weak, strong, and powerful, tender, a living oxymoron. As an oxymoron, Grace polarizes viewers much as she does characters on the series. Initially, the TNT forum was flooded with Christians offended by the show's depiction of drinking, smoking, nudity, and adultery. But others criticized the Christian response as unchristian. Writing on GodTube, Charles R. C. said, quote, Christians attacking the show missed the point. The show is for people who need it. If she were perfect, she wouldn't need God's help. This perspective, echoed elsewhere online, treats the series as a morality tale that captures God's point of view. As one post at TV.com noted, God thinks she is worth saving, so who are we to argue that point? Other viewers, less concerned with the divine perspective, like seeing a realistic character on TV. Quote, for those of us who once lived life in the fast lane that needed to be helped, we love you, Grace. Female cops felt special empathy. Quote, we cuss, we drink, we make stupid, risky sexual decisions. We find it impossible to commit because we find it impossible to trust. We doubt God is actually up there, but so would you if you saw what we see. Some criticize a double standard that condemns Grace for behaviors that would be acceptable for men. Said one viewer, quote, I've been wondering about the equality question for a long time. Why is Grace slutty, but there are few comments about Butcher, Ham, or any of the men she has slept with? Not surprisingly, online viewer response reflects conflicted attitudes towards female sexuality, especially in a religious context. Still, most treat Grace sympathetically, if not empathetically. Her behavior is problematic because it is self-destructive, not because it is sinful. Her story overcomes a divide between the Madonnas and the whores and invites viewers to see their own experiences, to use her experience, to help fashion that, for them, a model of redemptive womanhood. Saving Grace lasted only 3 seasons. Fox, the studio that produced it, was dissatisfied with its overseas and DVD sales, so it canceled it. Even though its numbers dropped from $6.4 million for the first season premiere to $3.5 million for season 3, TNT wanted to keep the show. It worked for them. Worked for them because Grace's sexual behavior was off-putting, but she also was very attractive. Her casual bed-hopping appalled some viewers, but others enjoyed watching a buff, unabashedly sexual woman enjoy herself. Likewise, viewers who would have preferred to see a good woman embrace Jesus were matched by those who liked spirituality trumping religion in Grace's metaphysical universe. Grace's attractiveness and the open-ended nature of her spiritual quest illustrate the impact of mediatization. Both reflect the need for commercial media to represent women and religiosity in ways that appeal to consumers. If Grace were a frumpy hag, or if Earl demanded that she don a burqa and pray 7 times a day, the show would have been a much harder sell. Similarly, the deeper structures of religion, ritual, and reenchantment have to meet audience expectations. notably the rituals that provide time and space for grace to encounter deeper religious realities, occur in daily life, not in the church. A familiar chore like cooking becomes a time-out-of-time affair, as Grace and Retta discuss the radical break that Earl has introduced into their world. A familiar place like Grace's living room becomes a ritual space when Earl fills it with religious objects. The message is that places and events become sacred when we pay special attention to what is happening around us. Saving Grace ritualizes the realities and structures of everyday life as Grace sees and experiences a world transformed by God's presence. That realization re-enchants the world for her and for her audience. For more than a century, sociologists have suggested that the iron cage of rationality, the result of privileging order, materialism, and rationalism, has drained the world of awe and the mystery necessary to cultivate Modlesky's utopian sensibilities. But Miller's characters embody alternatives. Retta, a scientist by training, has no problem reconciling Earl's appearance with her professional empiricism. For Retta, Earl's existence opens up a realm of questions. What about the virgin birth, the Trinity? Is there a heaven? Retta believes in mysteries that transcend everyday reality and in a God who works through daily life. When she examines Grace's clues, a feather from Earl's wings, his half-eaten taco, she analyzes them scientifically, what is Earl's DNA, as well as spiritually, what is his message for Grace. Retta represents a compatibility of science and faith. She is intellectually rigorous, yet she also sees a world of signs and wonders, and she challenges Grace to do the same. According to a 2010 survey, nearly 80% of Americans, including the 16% of those who don't belong to a formal religion, see those signs and wonders too. Saving Grace speaks to viewers who believe in miracles but don't belong to religious institutions, or who belong to religious institutions but are not quite sure what they believe. Communication scholars would say that the growing chasm between institutional religion and the American public, 25% of young adults don't adhere to a formal religion, reflects in part the growing influence of media in our lives, specifically its challenge to traditional religious authority. Media can make religious institutions superfluous. It links people, provides them with meaningful narratives, offers community, and proffers avenues to construct their identity. Moreover, you can do it in the privacy of your own home, at the time of your own choosing, in a manner that you enjoy. Saving Grace provides a case study of how a television show can create community, present a spiritual narrative, and offer illuminating questions, if not answers, for viewers. The protagonist's journey not only occurs outside the institutional church, it happens in spite of it. Grace comes to accept herself, develop strong relationships, and accept a power greater than herself. Her life is enriched by the something more, community, autonomy, transcendence, that most women, or many women, seek as an antidote to a daily existence shrunk by endless tasks, demanding jobs, and imperfect relationships. Moreover, Grace addresses a basic tension in many women's lives: how to reconcile our desire to be good with our need to be full sexual beings. By overcoming the tension between the Madonna and the whore, Grace finds redemption on her own terms. Thanks to the media, viewers may too. Thank you.
Please feel free to take 1 minute, refill your coffee cup or your glass of water, and then we'll get ready for our responses. All right, first bell. Let me introduce you to our two respondents, and then they will come forward in sequence without further interruption or introduction. I want to start with a person from whom you will hear first. Dr. Jamie Clark Soles is Associate Professor of New Testament at Perkins School of Theology. She earned her undergraduate degree at Stetson University in Florida. Her degree was received magna cum laude, and she was elected to membership in Phi Beta Kappa. She then went on to Yale Divinity School, where she received the Master of Divinity degree summa cum laude and continued her studies at Yale, where she earned the PhD in New Testament. Her teaching specialties, of course, within the range of New Testament scholarship, still have a remarkable diversity. She is truly an international specialist in materials related to the Johannine literature, specifically the Gospel of John. She has studied, written on, and taught about such topics as evil, suffering, death, and the afterlife. She has addressed topics concerning New Testament ethics, the Passion narratives, and what it means to preach the New Testament. Her publications include books on death and the afterlife in the New Testament. Her first major work, Scripture Cannot Be Broken, The Social Function of the Use of Scripture in the Fourth Gospel. And she has also most recently written a volume called Engaging the Word, the New Testament, and the Christian Believer, a Westminster John Knox book in 2010. Jamie is a wonderful colleague who has provided extraordinary service to Perkins School of Theology and to Southern Methodist University. She came to us as assistant professor of New Testament in 2001, has been tenured and promoted here, continues to be an active leader in the school, chairing various committees and so forth. She is also an ordained Baptist minister. She is a mother, a wife, and a competitive professional, I emphasize professional, racquetball player. The second respondent is Dr. Robin Lovin. Robin is the Cary M. McGuire University Professor of Ethics at Southern Methodist University. In that capacity, he has the freedom to teach in any department of the university in which he chooses. So he has, for example, taught courses within the law school in ethics and law. He has taught regularly at Perkins School of Theology, courses in moral theology. He has taught in the PhD program, the graduate program in religious studies, linking the departments of religious studies in Dedman College and the faculty at Perkins. Robin earned his undergraduate degree at Northwestern University and then went to Harvard, where he earned the Bachelor of Divinity degree and stayed on to complete his PhD at Harvard. His special interest in terms of teaching and research concerns social ethics, Protestant theological ethics, comparative religious ethics, and the history of ethics. He is an expert, among other important figures in the field, on Reinhold Niebuhr and on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He has written extensively on topics of Christian realism, racial justice, and issues of church and state. Two of his publications are Reinhold Niebuhr and Christian Realism, and Christian Ethics, an Essential Guide. He, too, has served the university and Perkins School of Theology in a number of capacities. Most important for me is he was my predecessor as dean at Perkins School of Theology. And someday, in another setting, I'll tell you that he saved my skin on the night that I came here for an interview and discovered the hotel had no room in the inn for my wife and me. And I called Robin, and he rescued me. Robin was, of course, a member of the Perkins faculty, served as dean And when he left the deanship, he stepped into his position as the Carrie Maguire University Professor of Ethics. He has served as president of the Society of Christian Ethics. He chaired an ethics task force here to develop an ethics policy for the university. He is an editor-at-large for the Christian Century, and he is a fellow of the Center for Theological Inquiry at Princeton Theological Seminary. He, too, is an ordained minister. Robin is a minister in the United Methodist Church, an ordained elder in the United Methodist Church, and a clergy member of the North Texas Annual Conference. So I invite you to join me in welcoming first Dr. Jamie Clark Soles. She will immediately be followed by Dr. Robin Lovin.
I have to add that Dr. Lovin is also the dean who hired me, so I have special affection for him as well. And I don't think you know this, but I just got a Kindle, and guess what my first book was that I bought? Not my own, Christian Ethics. So, well, good afternoon, everyone. Let me begin by saying what an honor it is to serve as a respondent to Dr. Winston, whose accomplishments are nearly innumerable, as far as I can tell, and whose expertise includes guiding us all through these exciting, epoch-making, existentially rich, and even explosive times. If these times do not strike you as exciting, epoch-making, existentially rich, and possibly explosive, then you might not be paying attention. One way that Winston helps us is through her work on religion and entertainment, summarized conveniently by the title of the book she edited, Small Screen, Big Picture, Television and Lived Religion. She is also responsible for the radio program TV and Parables of Our Time. On the website, we read this: Diane Winston appreciates good television, studies it, and brings many of its creators into her religion and media classes at the University of Southern California. In what some have called a renaissance in television drama, we examine how TV is helping us all tell our story and work through great confusions in contemporary life, end quote. Part of that story, as seen in the life of Grace, involves religious faith or lack thereof. Now, I teach New Testament here at Perkins, where I help, at least on my best days, to accomplish the school's mission to train women and men for faithful leadership in Christian ministry. My students have been called to help people tell their story and work through great confusions in contemporary life. On my students' best days, they do that in part by tying the story of the people they minister with into the grand story of God with us, narrated through Scripture from Genesis to Revelation. I use material from popular culture regularly in my teaching, because I don't know how you can actually teach the Gospels without using movies and fiction. I'm an ordained, might I add, female Baptist minister. So, like Grace, I find myself a female operating in a profession traditionally dominated by men. I have a daughter who is a freshman in high school and an 11-year-old son who are growing up in a heavily mediatized world. As a mom, I take it to be part of my job to help them tell their story and work through great confusions in contemporary life. We attend a church deeply shaped by postmodernism. Unlike Dr. Winston, I am a neophyte when it comes to religion and the media. I do contribute to workingpreacher.com and have recently published for the first time on Huffington Post. I've just been filmed for a new movie called, you ready for this? Hellbound? I'm listed as a blogger for Emergent Village on Pathios.com, but I have yet to actually blog. I have research leave coming up so soon. I have signed on to these various ventures because I know that Dr. Winston is right about mediatization, which she defined for you as a historical, ongoing, long-term process in which more and more media emerge and are institutionalized, thus causing media to increasingly become relevant for the social construction of everyday life, society, and culture as a whole. She is leading out regarding how to engage this reality well, and I, for one, intend to follow her. I share some of this autobiographical information because I imagine it determines which aspects of her essay grabbed me the most, and because the very nature of this symposium has to do with the combination of the public and the personal. In her own way, Dr. Winston is a modern incarnation of Jesus. Now, lest she get a Messiah complex, which usually ends poorly, let me be more specific. She asks us pointed, crucial, what one might call clarifying questions. That's Jesus at his best. He asks, what are you looking for? Do you wish to be made well? And he asks for our own sake, not for his. So does Diane Winston. She asks, might media supersede institutional religion in telling religious stories, creating religious communities, and facilitating religious encounters? She presses on with other great questions, but I think they all come together in this one. That is, how are ritual, reenchantment, and redemption experienced in a mediatized world? Winston is right when she names as crucial categories the deep human longings for identity, meaning, and community, the matrix both for spiritual searching and religious teaching. Now, my family and I have recently, if belatedly, undertaken the watching of Lost. We have, I am proud to say, accomplished season 1 out of 6. Now, honestly, I thought Claire was never going to have that baby. I also wonder if it's okay as a seminary professor to just wish they would off Shannon sooner rather than later. Anyway, add to all of this to the fact that over Christmas break, we watched all 8 Harry Potter movies over a 2-week period, with only a timeout for an 8-day visit for us from some relatives whose religious convictions keep them from finding it an appropriate thing to do as a Christian to watch Harry Potter. So my kids have laid down the law with me, right? Here's what they say. Mom, if you do not stop comparing every single show to the Bible and Christianity, we're kicking you out of here. But the connections beg to be made. Now, I haven't seen any episodes of Saving Grace, though after engaging Winston's essay, I'm keenly interested in doing so. But I am automatically drawn to what Winston calls compromised characters pursuing ambiguous ends. The same phrase describes characters in Harry Potter and Lost, right? And did I mention I'm a Bible scholar? Name a prominent, significant, compelling character in the biblical narrative from Genesis to Revelation who couldn't be described at some point as a compromised character pursuing ambiguous ends. Eve, Adam, Abraham, Sarah, Rebecca, Jacob, Leah, Laban, Moses, David, Paul. Would-be modern anti-heroes, please take your place in line behind the ancients, if you will. Winston nails it when she notes that at the heart of many of the series that have gripped the American populace are, quote, questions of meaning, identity, and community. Yet rather than reflecting a utopian sensibility, the desire for something more, they bespeak what she calls a dystopian world weariness that wonders, is this all there is? In what I take to be one of the most brilliant, poignant, and true sentences in her essay, Winston writes this about grace. Its hero's struggle is neither for worldly success nor romantic love, but for the redemption manifest in accepting herself, loving others, and recognizing a higher power. To me, this is a heroine made in the image of the Apostle Paul, especially as he ministered to the likes of the Corinthians, who might even surprise Grace, what with the guy sleeping with his stepmom, Christians sleeping with prostitutes, Christians suing each other blind, Christians withholding sex from their partners, and so on. I think Grace and Paul would be great conversation partners, actually, although I dare say he would push a button or two of hers and vice versa. Paul did nothing in his life if not minister to reluctant saints. Winston notes about Grace that at the heart of her story is an unsought and unwanted religious calling. Again, we can name many stories from the Bible who share, many characters from the Bible who share that story. Abraham, Noah, Moses, Jonah, Paul, maybe even Jesus' own mother, at least for a minute or two. Like Grace, these guys are unlikely heroes. but have what we might politely call, or they and Grace have what we might politely call issues, right? But isn't it the fact that they are so real, so flawed, so us, that makes them each captivating, inspiring figures, at least for postmodern types? And this is where I finally want to land in response to Dr. Winston's great work, that is, on the postmodern landscape. Recall that Winston asked, might media supersede institutional religion in telling religious stories, creating religious communities, and facilitating religious encounters? Now, many traditional churches are finding declining membership, giant church buildings with tiny, mostly older congregations. But of course, Americans have not stopped being religious. They haven't even given up on church. There's a new energy, and extremely vital religious communities are cropping up everywhere. But things are being conceptualized and practiced quite differently, and these groups don't work in a way that can be quantified at all. In addition to the wonderful Center for Religious Leadership that this presentation is a part of, Perkins also has a Center for Missional Wisdom led by Dr. Elaine Heath. She is helping our students to establish these kinds of vital grassroots communities. So I encourage you to check that out. In addition, you may have heard of churches that are connected with what has come to be known as the emergent church. All of these kinds of grassroots religious communities operate in a way that is commensurate with the postmodern reality that we find ourselves in today. Grace would fit perfectly, I think, at one of these churches. In a nutshell, postmodernism can be characterized as follows: always questioning, suspicious of authority, highly attuned to power dynamics among individuals, societies, and cultures, wary of any project that seeks to eliminate differences, extremely attentive to the ways language is used, since language creates realities, marked by epistemological humility, that is to say, we don't know as much as we pretend to know, views the world through an ironic lens, things are not as they appear, eschews notions of absolute truth in order to defend truth. Notions of truth are less like Stonehenge, that is solid, monolithic, unchanging, hard, and more like Etch-a-Sketch. Fluid, sketchy, diverse, subject to revision as more information or news is revealed. I've described emergence at length elsewhere, but I'm going to note a few characteristics of them particularly relevant to today's discussion in light of Dr. Winston's essay. And I go to a church like this. They are a narrative people, as opposed to doctrinal, dogmatic, systematic, or propositional. They tend toward hopeful irony and serious play. They relish paradox. Emergents note that Jesus took special interest in those whose lives were an obvious mess. So when they approach the text, they don't fear the ugly parts. They shine a spotlight on them and ask what they can tell us about God's work in the world and in our lives. How do these texts move us toward hope? And in what ways do they implicate us as a community and as individuals? Emergents reject binary paradigms. So Madonna, whore, right? They reject binary paradigms. Where others see either or, they see both and. Emergents are communal and tend to do life together. In common parlance, you might say they spend a lot of time together outside of church, but that would be a problematic statement on many counts. First of all, many don't meet in a physical church building at all. They rent a space here or there, or they meet in homes or in a restaurant or often a bar. Second, the notion of outside church implies that one can move between church and life as if they are different spheres, and no emergent would buy that. It's all of a piece, and one does not change one's persona, behavior, trust me, dress, speech, or conversation topics. One doesn't put on a church face to come to church and make the pastor and congregation believe one has it all together. Emergents are hyperlinked and extremely technology savvy, and social networks are a given. They do not countenance a spirituality where it's just me, Jesus, and my Bible. They do not come to the garden alone. Okay, well, maybe they do, but then they quickly text their friends or post their status on Facebook or Twitter to find out if what the Son of God disclosed was normal or concerning. Many emergents have experienced a sense of exclusion and being the odd person out, so they are sympathetic to the plight of the misfit. Notions of authority work differently among emergents. Nothing and no one has unquestioned absolute authority. Authority is earned and always provisional. They like to think a lot. But they don't just stay in their heads. Emergents are heavy on incarnation, on embodied faith that involves all of the senses. If the Word of God became flesh and dwelt among us, that is, if the Word of God came out of the birth canal of a woman's body, grew, ate, went to the bathroom, bathed, struggled against demons, sweated, wept, exulted, was transfigured, was physically violated, and rotted away in a tomb just before being gloriously resurrected, then the Bible must have flesh on it. If a valley of dry bones can live again, then bones and blood and bread and flesh and bodies should never be left behind when we are trying to understand the grime and glory of Scripture. Any interpretation that denounces the material created order, including our own bodies, should be suspect. From birth to death, our bodies swell and shrink. They are wet with milk and sweat and urine and vomit and sex and blood and water and wounds that fester and stink and are healed and saved and redeemed and die and are resurrected. If you can't glory in, or at least talk about, these basic realities in church while reading Scripture, then how can Scripture truly intersect with or impact life? Maybe Grace would understand that. I know for a fact that Diane Winston does. Thank you.
Well, I want to begin, too, by thanking Diane Winston for her remarkable synthesis of faith and contemporary culture. But I also have to confess that when I began to think about how I was going to respond to that lecture, I wondered why Todd Raspberry would ask me to be one of the respondents. It dawned on me on about page 4 of Diane Winston's draft that I've never seen a single episode of any of the shows that she mentioned. I spend most of my time thinking about religion and politics, and the last time I checked my DVR, it was 65% full of random episodes of Washington Week and a string of PBS documentaries that date back to July of 2009. I still keep thinking I'm going to watch those someday. What kept me reading, however, was my next thought. I realized that although I had never watched any of those programs, I knew vaguely what most of them were about. And I even knew the names of some of the main characters. I don't know exactly how I acquired this knowledge. Ads during news programs, maybe, or reviews in newspapers, or notices that escaped my pop-up blocker while I was web browsing. Whatever it was, the fact that I knew a lot about these programs without ever having watched them was itself pretty good evidence for the claim that we live in a mediatized world. Professors are apt to complain that our students no longer know the characters in the Bible or the plot lines in Shakespeare or the main events of world history, and we lament the loss of a common cultural language. Well, the loss of Shakespeare and the Bible may be lamentable, but we're not doing badly for a common cultural language, are we? if people like me know the character of Tony Soprano and the story of Oz, a lot of people never, you know, in the classical days, a lot of people never read Shakespeare in the Bible either. But the point was that we had a useful cultural language because people understood what a reference to Hamlet or a burning bush was all about. And these TV dramas likewise provide us with shared images by which to understand our experience and communicate it to others. That's the most important thing that a common cultural language does. Now, the difference, to be sure, is that in a mediatized world, you don't have to process the experience to communicate it. You just hit the like button, and the whole experience is there for your Facebook friends to follow. They can have the same experience for themselves. It makes it easy to be unreflective, but that doesn't mean that the experiences themselves are superficial. One of the things that you notice about Diane Winston's description of saving grace is that the theological tension between personal autonomy and divine sovereignty is written into the story from beginning to end. And that's one of the profound questions of Christian doctrine and a recurrent personal issue in every life of faith. Those are deep theological waters. And oddly enough, the going wisdom for too many preachers is that they are too deep for a Sunday morning sermon, right? That if we're going to reach people and hold their attention, we have to come up with some version of your best life now. You have to tell them that what you want is really within your grasp, that all you have to do is reach out and take it, that what you think you want is what God wants you to have, or pretty close to it. Just learn to love the you you are and say yes to your hopes and aspirations and pronounce the benediction. Now, people will probably be too polite to say it as they shake the preacher's hand on the way out of church, but they know that's not true. And the fact that a lot of them watched 46 episodes of a drama about a woman who had to transcend both self-hatred and self-love to find redemption suggests that they know that their lives are more complicated than most of our sermons dare to make them. That doesn't mean they'll stop coming to church. But in a mediatized world, it's important for the churches to ask themselves not only how many people are coming, but what they're coming for. Because it might turn out that a lot of people are getting their religious instruction from HBO and going to church for entertainment. And in a roundabout way, that brings me back to the connection between religion and politics that I spend most of my time thinking about. Political theorists and ethicists spend a lot of time worrying about the rules of what they call public reason, about how we separate private religious convictions from the public language of policy and politics. And it makes sense in principle to worry about that, but the problem is in practice, it's hard to tell what's a religious reason and what isn't. Religious people often have a hard time separating their religious beliefs from the other reasons why they believe what they do. And although there are pockets of self-disciplined secularity, the public world is so pervasively religious that the idea of a non-religious reason is a little like a black swan or a white rhinoceros. It might exist, but it's so rare that we usually can't count on having enough of them to make up a serious argument. The neutral, non-religious public square was an artificial creation that existed for a short time for the same reasons that Diane Winston pointed out that we had in the world of three network broadcast television, a secular space where nobody ever seemed to be religious in any particular way. The Eisenhower belief, you know, got to believe something and I don't care what it is. We didn't have, as it were, enough bandwidth to deal with a variety of religious authorities and a depth of religious experience and the multiple ways that those forces actually play themselves out in our individually different lives. So we settled for an abstraction in which we can clearly distinguish the religious from the non-religious and cleanly set the religious aside for further consideration in approved ecclesiastical contexts. By contrast, today's mediatized world reflects the interpenetration of the religious and the secular, the public and the personal, so that you never know when a scruffy old man is going to show up with a message from God. The effort to deny that, the effort to keep our politics free of the complex mix of doubt and faith with which real people approach reality, is having some of the same effects on politics that it has on religion. Because in politics, too, you'll notice that those who are responsible for the authorized public presentations of truth have simplified things so much that what goes on in politics no longer reflects the difficult choices that people now see more accurately presented on HBO and TNT. In politics, we are told that the choices to be made are choices between good and evil, all one or all the other. We're told that our choices for the future are not limited by the choices we made in the past. We can have complete change. We are told that someone who deserves our vote is ready to bear our burdens for us, so that if we just make that choice, we won't have to make any other choices. And people won't tell the politicians this as they shake their hand leaving the caucus, but just like they won't tell the preacher when they leave church, they know that's not true. They'll watch Saving Grace or Six Feet Under or even The Biggest Loser if they want to see what real choices are like. And meanwhile, organized politics, like organized religion, begins to function more as a form of entertainment. This is not good for the future of religion or for the future of democracy. But what Diane Winston has taught me is that I won't be able to do anything about that by blaming it on some television program that I've never actually watched. The question is not about the media. The question is whether those of us who try to speak the truth in religion or in politics know enough about complicated lives and hard choices to engage the imaginations of people who really have to live them. Thank you.
We have come to the part where you get an opportunity to engage with our three speakers. I've covenanted with you to quit at 5:30. I'm the timekeeper. So we've got a time for a couple of questions. And I'm going to ask if the three of you can spend just a few minutes after we finish for folks who didn't get to ask or don't want to ask in a public setting can come and engage you as well. I'm going to ask that if you have a question, you raise your hand. I'm going to bring you the mic. And if you just say your first name and then ask your question, we're recording, and I want to get the questions, make sure we have those recorded as well. Yes.
First name and then your question. Yeah, my name is Brandon, and the question that I had was when you were talking about the saving grace and the story of Grace and how she started to, you know, come around and kind of the aha moment, I guess, if you will, at the end. It seemed that a lot of that came from her interactions with other people and her interactions with this angel, and then at the end with the connection with the, you know, I'm just the messenger like FedEx. And it appears that what the final outcome would be is that you would realize from her life that what it says is the importance of that human interaction. And while I agree that that with media, it can help us learn about our own lives, but it seems that the very outcome that we learn is that media is only good for pointing towards those human relationships and those interactions, like we see with a lot of the biblical characters as well, that the final outcome is that what really matters is to interact with one another in order to also understand an interaction with God. And I just wonder if you would agree with that, or if there's something else that you would add to maybe point back to the importance of the how media can overlap over the religion or even take over.
Is that for Diane?
Yes.
I have to just say that those responses were great, and I know now that I need to go take a course in preaching so I can match them. We academics aren't taught to like speak with such florid expression and to be so fabulous to listen to. So thank you both. Plus, you were brilliant. I think it's a both and. I think in dealing with those kind of issues that you work horizontally and vertically, and you know your interactions with people are also reflective of your interactions with God. And I think that's what Nancy Miller probably was trying to point to, so that you can't say that it was only through her experiences with other people that she experienced a change, because I don't think the change would have occurred had she not been grappling with her relationship with something larger than that. So, but okay. they're the ministers, so they might have a better.
Another question? Yes, right here, and then I'm going to come. Who else had their hand over here? Okay, I've got three.
This is a question, more a comment. I have actually seen Saving Grace and never watched the final episode because I was so connected and attached to Grace and her community that I could not watch what happened, knowing that it was going to happen because the season had been called to an end. But I think it speaks to me in the level of intimacy that we can actually create, and I don't think it's false intimacy, with characters, fictional characters, on the television or in movies. And I attend church. I work as a hospital chaplain. There's very little that reflects in those experiences the level of intimacy that we get through even the mediaization of these lives. I mean, Grace, as written by Nancy Miller, was incredibly reflective of sexuality. She was not a mother, which I found in some ways a great relief, because so many good girl characters end up having very complicated relationships with children. So, I mean, I don't know if you have time to speak to that in our next 3 minutes, but that level of intimacy that we create with fictional characters when they're as visual as they are in movies and in television, for me, in some ways, even more than books, because it goes on 46 episodes, whereas Harry Potter has to come to an end at some point.
Since that wasn't a question, I'm going to hold that as a comment. And
yes, thank you. I'm an SMU faculty member, and I can talk to Jamie and Robin anytime I want. And this isn't one of them. So my question for Diane is, do you know of any television portrayals of the Salvation Army? And if so, how those portrayals are rendered? Yeah.
Well, you all can correct me if I'm wrong. Most of the portrayals of the Salvation Army are cameos in shows about television or shows that are trying to telegraph an idea of religious service in a non-sectarian perspective. Salvationists were very much represented in popular media in the aughts, in the 1900s and 20s, and they were sort of the religious icon in many ways, but they really dropped out of sight after the 1950s, and I don't think there have been any strong depictions of them since then. Right. I do want to say, in regards to your question, that is, It's so true, and scholars of media write about this, that television establishes relationships with viewers in ways that no other media does. And as you say, it's partly the long arc of television, the fact that they're in your home with you, the fact that the characters, you know, evolve in more real ways than people can do in movies and over longer times than many, many books. So it does create an intimacy that's unlike any other. Just think of those soap operas that go on for 20 years. I mean, these people may mean more to you than people in your work life or your family. So, yes, I think that intimacy is very deep, and that helps explain why a character like Grace could elicit so much confessional material on the Internet, because people were feeling as if this woman represented their lives in ways that no one else had or could.
Kirk Watson, my question is, how is it that mainline denominations can embrace the emergent population and the growth of communication through media within the structures that are already in place? How can we embrace that? And I would love response from any of the three.
Or all three.
Or all three.
Absolutely.
Please go to the microphone. This is the last question, so we'll give each of you a chance to respond if you'd like, but I'd like you to do it here so we can record it. And Jamie, since you spoke, you have to come go first, since you all can't decide.
So can you rephrase the question? So how can... You asked how can traditional mainline churches embrace... emergent, postmodern type people and all of that within the structures that already exist?
Yes, within the structures that already exist. Is there any type of movement or encouragement for mainline denominations to be able to embrace that?
Oh, sure, because every mainline denomination, Brandon, I think you know something about this too, every mainline denomination now has an emergent arm. So the Luther emergent, Presby emergent, Angle emergent. So the mainline denominations are, in fact, doing this and trying to tap in. How well it's integrating, hard to say, because there's, for the same reasons, it's hard to, in the same church, have, what do we call it, the contemporary worship service versus the traditional one, the kinds of things you're trying to pull together. It's a very different, I mean, honestly, institutionalized traditional churches are built on modernist principles to a large degree, and a lot of people like modernist principles. So I think the question is even deeper. Can the traditional mainline churches recognize and embrace postmodern reality? And I think that's a really big question. But in other words, I think this is not the kind of thing. A lot of people in mainline churches are trying to do emergent worship in their church. But they just come and visit emergent churches, and they go back, and they have people pull a scripture out of a sandbox or paint or finger paint or something. And it doesn't work because that's at a surface level, and it's not understanding and operating what needs and realities people are bringing to the table. I mean, like my daughter said, we've been going to Arapahoe a bit. I'll shut up. We've been going to Arapahoe United Methodist Church, and she's like, I do have to say, it's kind of refreshing, Mom, to be in a church where someone actually says something like, wow, will you please open your hymnals? Or where the pastor doesn't actually use the word shit as part of, you know, the conversation. And I'm like, well, some people do church differently, you know, because they've grown up in a postmodern church, so they think that's kind of weird that people would, you know, not cuss in the middle of a church service. So the realities are just far deeper and far more structural, I think. And you've asked an important question.
Robin?
I'm not the person to ask about postmodernism, I'm afraid. Let me just... Bill mentioned my fascination with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, so I'll just tell a quick Bonhoeffer story. In the confessing church where Bonhoeffer trained people for ministry, one of the things that was a little unusual about that at the time is there were women students in those in that seminary, and they went out and filled congregations. And One woman who graduated from Bonhoeffer Seminary went off to a remote village in Bavaria and became the pastor there and spent an entire career and retired probably in her late 60s or 70s, you know, many years after the Second World War, so that whole generations of people in this rather isolated place had grown up with her ministry. And a male pastor was sent to replace her, and the children thought that a man preaching was the funniest thing they had ever seen. I offer that as a parable, not as a set of instructions. But, you know, the institutional church has survived for a long time with a lot of changes. I think it's crucial that we not try and make those changes by, yeah, looking and seeing what's happening and then see if we can imitate it. But that the church, if it is the church, will learn to respond to these forces so that someday it'll look weird that we didn't do any of these things. That, I think, is true.
Diane, I'm going to give you the last word.
Obviously, I can't answer this question from firsthand experience since I don't have the pastoral background. But I will say that I have been really intrigued that the emergent movement transcends Protestantism and that there are Catholic emergents, Jewish emergents. And so what really interests me about this phenomena is how it does speak to this new generation and how, as I said earlier, 25% of young people say that they don't belong to a formal religion, but yet many of them feel spiritual longings. I mean, how do we speak to them in language that is authentic to both the tradition but also to their own experience? And I think this is a question that's going to be roiling people at seminaries of all variations for the next couple of years.
Let's give our speakers another round of applause for thank you all very much.